Well, thank you for having me. It's really exciting time to be in this field. These panel really shows the maps of the galaxy clusters, gravitational lensing, X-ray optical images, and Zeldovich effect of some of the clusters. I mean, these measurements are becoming so good, so precise, that it's really giving us crisp pictures of the formation of galaxy clusters. It has become so well that I think that it's really probing the various components. I mean, these different probes are probing the various components of the galaxy clusters, including dark matter, gas, and stars. And these measurements really put together it has become a time that I think we really want to make sense of these rich data set. In order to do that, I think there has.
I haven't been impressed with Snyder's Zeldovich, actually.
I think it's still up and coming, I would say. Yeah, I think there's a significant.
It's been the promise of Snyder's Zeldovich, the promise of Snyder's Zeldovich, the promise of Snyder's Zeldovich. When's it going to deliver? Point to a cluster result based on Snyder's Zeldovich that you say that, hey, this is interesting.
Yeah, well, I think that. I think this is, yes, I mean, I agree that, but
you
I think.
Edit that slide.
Was that? Okay, well, I will come through this and maybe talk a little bit about this, what this
but
means
keep
by.
Promising. I'm going to retire soon.
Okay, well, I'll have some slide that has actually shows you the data and shows you some results from the current observations, and I'll just have one slide just to talk about that. But then
haven't been published, I don't think.
Oh yes, but I think there are results that are published this year, and then there are samples of clusters for sample of 30, 40 clusters, trying to. Show the scaling relations of the Sanyo-Zeldovich cluster scaling relation and so forth. So I'll briefly present the results on that, and maybe we can discuss more on that.
See, I have a more naive question.
Yes.
To what extent is it known or not known that the dark matter in clusters is the same as the dark matter in galaxy halos?
Qualitatively
different.
Well, the qualitatively, we believe that the qualitatively they are thought to be the collisionless particle, which does not seem to give rise to the electromagnetic interactions or anything that we think we observe. So qualitatively, we think that these are more like this properties of the dark matter that we think it has a similar behavior. So that's.
But these are, clusters out of galaxies, and, since galaxies fall into clusters, presumably they also carry their dark matter with them.
I agree, it's reasonable. I just wondered if there was any evidence other than just the pure gravitational.
So far, I think it has
What's
been...
What's wrong with gravitational?
Nothing. I'm not the expert in gravitational.
It's not like it hasn't been discovered. It's been discovered.
Right.
No, dark matter. It's just a question of whether or not you're happy with gravity or insist on something else.
It's not such an unreasonable question to ask.
How would you tell?
Well, so far it's been the evidence has been the gravitational, and through that, I think beyond that, I think we have not evidence that would distinguish that whether the particles are different or not in different scale system. So I think that the talk today will focus on. There has been a lot of talks about the effects of baryons on the dark matter and the interaction between baryons and dark matter. And so there has been quite a bit of talk. So I will briefly review some of the recent progress in the understanding the interactions of effects of baryons on dark matter. But then in this talk, I will mainly focus on the properties of baryons, which gives rise to this effect. These are the collaborators who contributed to the work I've been presenting today. Andre Kraftsov from the University of Chicago. We've been working on the simulations of the galaxy formation of galaxy clusters. Also working in collaboration with Alexei Viklinin and trying to do the comparisons of the simulations with the X-ray observations. These are two graduate students from the University of Chicago, also helping us to analyze the simulation results and perform the comparison with the recent observations. So here's the outline of my talk. I will briefly describe the cosmological simulations of galaxy cluster that includes baryons. In the colloquium last week given by Andrei Kravtsov, he has talked about the effect of baryons on the mass distributions, in particular the mass profiles and the shapes of dark matter, and what's the implication of these results on the lensing observation or interpretation of lensing observations. So I would just briefly review the results, but then the focus of this talk, or actually the conclusion from that talk, was that the baryon does have some give rise to important effect, but the magnitude of these effects are sensitive to exactly what the baryons are doing in galaxy clusters. So in this talk, I'll focus on the properties of baryons. How realistic are the distribution properties of baryons in these simulations, and how these properties compare in simulation compare with the recent observation. I also wanted to briefly talk about how can these observations of baryons, like stars and gas, can help with the lensing studies. So I hope to mention one or two things that might be useful for the lensing study as well. So let me just start by describing briefly about this simulation that we do. This is the cosmological simulation of galaxy cluster, starting from the well-defined initial condition. That's consistent with the cold dark matter model, with the consistent with the various cosmological observations. It follows the collisionless dynamics of dark matter. In order to treat the baryons, we also self-consistently follow the gas dynamics on top of the dark matter. In order to actually study the effect of baryons, there is a complex physical processes that would go into the formation and evolution of the galaxy themselves. And these processes that we include in this code include the radiative cooling, heating of the gas, and when the gas cools and form and it actually forms star, we use the phenomenological prescription for star formation based on the Kennicott recipe. So this is because the resolution is not good enough to resolve molecular clouds. So we basically use this phenomenological prescription to follow the formation of stars. These stars, when it's created in the very dense regions of the cold temperature gas, presumably where all the molecular clouds form, the code generates spawn from those cell of the gas, the cold dense gas, a stellar particle, which is usually of order 10 to the 6 solar mass. So you can think of the stellar particle that get generated in this simulation as a sort of single stellar population coming out of born at the same time with the same metallicity environment. These stellar particle does the energy feedback into the environment as the stellar particle traverses through the cluster of potentials. So the thermal energy feedback due to the supernova is accounted in these simulations. When it does the energy feedback, it also injects the mass and also the metals back into the environment. So the metal enrichment is also self-consistently followed. We do this by two means for the assuming the initial mass function, the normal initial mass function, and we follow the evolution of the enrichment by type 2 and type 1a supernova separately. So we track the metal enrichment as well. Now this leads back into the cooling calculation. The cooling calculation depends on the local densities and temperature, but it also depends on metallicity. So these calculations on metal enrichment and radiative cooling are done self-consistently in the simulations. And some of the physics that we have not yet put in the simulation that I'm presenting today are the AGN feedback, thermal conduction, effects of magnetic field, cosmic ray. These are not included in this current simulation. So you can think of this as a sort of minimum number of processes at least needed in order to follow the galaxy formation. So these are the pictures, the snapshot of the one of the simulated cluster. The top left panel is the dark matter distributions. You can see that they're on the bulk size of this simulation is of order 80 H inverse megaparsec. The peak resolution it's achieved is a 2 H inverse kiloparsec. So it achieves a dynamic range of about 16,000. It does so by using this adaptive mesh refinement technique, which increases the resolution in the high density regions. So this shows the, and here is the gas distribution. You can see the filaments along these directions, the distribution of halo, as well as the distribution of clumps, or seems to be, I think this map shows that it's elongated, so along the line of the filaments. And this is where the last major merger actually has occurred. This is the line in which that the last major merger has occurred, and it's elongated in this direction. The inclusion of the star formation allows you to form, to follow, and basically follow the evolution of stellar components. So this is just the map of the stellar distribution. Has a very strong central CD galaxies here. There is a central galaxies of the small infalling group, which is actually associated with this dark matter clump over here. You can see that the sort of enhancement in density is in also in this area. The entropy map is showing you the distribution of entropy. The thing high entropy here is showing you the radius at which that the gas and void, the pristine gas and void, is accreting and getting shock heated for the first time.
Are these all panels to scale?
Yes, these are actually all H inverse megaparsec. So Birol region, I think, would be something of order 2 H inverse megaparsec across. So this would be about the Birol region of the cluster. Shock radius is something like 2 to 3 Birol radius.
I'm wondering about the gas, because it goes so far out.
There is a gas in the filaments, and you can see it does go. I mean, I guess you're worried about the.
How much gas are we missing just by observing the Chandra then? Because Chandra normally doesn't go that far out, right?
That's right. So yeah, if Chandra really goes out to about half the Birol radius, let's say R500, that would be about half the Birol radius. Well, Birol radius, as I said, is about 2 megaparsec in diameter here. So it will be really, what you're really observing is actually this inner regions right here. So that corresponds to these regions.
It's the central sort of 1% linear to both boxes you observe each other.
Yeah, so that would be, it goes out to about 1 megaparsec in radius for this kind of system. Yeah, so I think it would be somewhere around here. That's right. So that's where you're probing. That's where you're probing. But there's a lot of low density gas in surrounding, which is accreting onto this cluster. Okay, and this temperature map also shows that the temperature is hotter in the inner regions where the shock heating is strong, and then the temperature seems to decline in the outskirts. The simulation also has this metal distribution, which is very peaked in the inner regions, or there is also high metallicity associated with this the neighborhood of the infalling galaxies. So these are the snapshot of the simulations. This really, the key here is to try to really go for high resolution in order to resolve galaxies. So the way the simulation we do is now we don't really follow the cluster galaxy in all of the 80 H inverse megaparsec. We actually add high resolution particle to resolve this individual clusters by first running the low resolution simulation with a uniform resolution, identify the clusters the particle which ends up in the cluster, go back in initial condition as a high resolution particle of those region which ends up forming this one cluster, and we achieve high resolution that way. And the spatial resolution is basically achieved by this use of the adaptive mesh refinement technique, it resolves the scale is down to about 2 H inverse kiloparsec in this type of simulations. The basic idea of doing this simulation is to try to study first the galaxy formation, but also study the effects of galaxy formation, the mass distribution, as well as the properties of gas that we observe with X-ray and Sanyo-Zoldovich effect. The simulation we've done so far is we simulate a sample of 16 clusters in the concordance cosmological model, and we run the two sets of runs. First, with the cooling and star formation on, that means we turn on all of these processes and run simulation. We also run the same set of simulations starting from the same initial condition by turning off these processes of galaxy formation by sort of turning off the cooling and star formation, and just follow the gas dynamics. Now, by comparing these two sets of simulation, the goal is to assess the effects of galaxy formation, what kind of effect those would have on mass distribution of galaxy cluster, as well as the hot intercluster medium. So this is the topic that was touched by a number of speakers at this conference. Oleg Gunetti at the conference, and last week Andrei Kravtsov talked about the effects of gas cooling on the mass distribution of clusters. Now, the first thing that was pointed out was that in the innermost regions, so here I'm taking the one of the simulated cluster run without cooling and star formation and with cooling and star formation. It's the same clusters. By plotting the mass distribution of the same cluster with and without cooling and star formation, you are trying to assess what impact the gas cooling would have on the mass distribution. Now, what you can see here is that the cooling and star formation has a significant mass enhancement in the inner region, say the 1/10 of the virial radius. So this virial radius of this cluster is of order megaparsec, so this is about 100 kiloparsec. In this region, you see the significant enhancement of mass, while the inner about 50 kiloparsec or so, or the 5% of the virial radius, is actually dominated by the stellar components. But then, the stellar components, due to the gas cooling, leads to the contraction of dark matter. This is the effect that's well documented in the literature, the first proposed by Egan and Lindenbell and Sandage, 1967, and there has been a many following paper about the effects of gas cooling on contraction of dark matter. And you see that the enhancement mass here is actually mostly due to this effect. It's still this region outside of 50 kiloparsec to 100 kiloparsec or so is still dominated by the dark matter, and this enhancement is comes from this contraction of dark matter due to baryons.
Is correct when you said 5% effect out to 5 times.
Yes. So the next thing, I think the effect is much more subtle. As you see, I'm showing you the sort of fractional mass deviation here. But as you see, this is the same cluster, and plotting the fractional deviation of the mass, you can see that the deviation, let's say take the R virial radius. Our virial radius right here, there is enhancement in the same cluster of mass by about 5%. So this is this what happened when you actually include the cooling and star formation. Now, the effect is, yes, the effect is subtle, but this effect could be potentially important for the weak lensing study if you're trying to probe the masses out to the outskirts of the cluster. So this is a relatively new effect that we kind of notice when we look more closer in details. Additional effect of this cooling, which is discussed a lot in this conference or in the colloquium, was that these baryons also make the triaxial halo rounder. And I think you saw many pictures of that, so I will not show this here. Now, these results have an important implication on the strong lensing as well as weak lensing. Strong lensing, of course, that the enhancement in mass within, say, about 100 kiloparsec, which is about the Einstein radius of the cluster, enhances the strong lensing cross-section and therefore the abundance of arcs. Now, the small...
How much have you cooled? I mean, so something like, if you turn this 12, is the cooled mass?
Yeah, so I think the cooled mass is, dominates the most of the mass within, say, about 0.05 of the virial radius. Yes, but beyond that, you know, out to about 100 kiloparsec, about this radius, it's actually mostly still dark matter dominated region. The effect seems to come from this effect of contraction of dark matter, we believe, in the simulations.
Isn't your effect that you have more baryons in that very radius when you add cooling? Could that just be explained by the very fact that your halo is rounder? Because in Z1, you average, you know, the, say, ellipsoidal isophores for the dark matter, the baryons are a bit more rounded than the baryons because of the pressure forces. In the other case, you have closer to spherically symmetric system. That you get some systematic differences from the one to the other.
I believe that effect... In this case, let's see. I think it could, well, yeah, I think it could be possible, but
a bit of problems with the looking is how round are objects, what is the flattening of halo, and really, if you go to the 5% level, it really depends on how you're averaging over your halos, whether you fit the ellipsoids or whether you're doing a mass profile in spherical shells. This easily introduces errors at that level.
Could be right. So what we did is, yes, that was the spherical averaging in this case. And so, yeah, I haven't done the calculative exercise, but I think this is definitely an important exercise to do to actually account for the asphericities in the case where you don't have this rounding of the halo. So, yes.
Question?
Yes.
It's not the same as Neil's question, but the long-standing problem with simulations including baryons is to, and cooling, is how to regulate that cooling and avoid cooling too in baryons. So, have you regulated the cooling in some way, or if you haven't, isn't this an upper limit on?
Sure, definitely. So there is a heating that's included. It's due to the supernova energy feedback, which certainly helped to regulate the cooling.
AGN.
But then there's no AGN. So I think the conclusion from the previous speakers was that the effect is generic when you have cooling. This kind of effect is generic. However, this amplitude, the magnitude to which that this happens, kind of depends on details of the baryonic physics. So that really points out that that would be sort of, this is the sort of topic that I'd like to discuss today, is to what extent that the baryon components are well reproduced, and to what extent it fails with this limited number of physical processes included. So by comparing this to observations, we try to identify the kinds of physics or kinds of phenomena that's kind of missing from the current modeling of the cluster formation. So the first thing we can look is to check how realistic the properties of simulated galaxy cluster is, whether you actually have the number of galaxies in cluster right. What this is showing here is the number of galaxies brighter than the Arban magnitude of -20 as a function of cluster mass. And these data points are from the simulated clusters. And the Arban magnitude is calculated by applying these spectral thin synthesis code on each stellar particles. And we compute the Arban magnitude, count the number of galaxies in each cluster with the varying masses. Compared to the data by the Rosa-Olsky survey and SDSS, and the number of galaxies here. The point here, I think, is that the abundance of the sort of L-star galaxy-like system in cluster seems to be reasonably well reproduced in this simulation. So this is just a number.
Of that line.
What's that? Yes.
What's the slope of that line?
The slope of this line is actually 0.92. Plus minus something like 0.03. That's for the data. And the simulations are more or less following that law. But the next thing is to sort of look at the galaxy colors and luminosities and see how they're reproduced. So the top panel shows the color magnitude relation of G minus R color plot as a function of the R band absolute magnitude. Now, first thing you notice is that there is a clear red sequence in this region. These are the galaxies that's enclosed within 3 times the R200 of the simulated clusters. And these are the galaxies in one of the simulated clusters. Just for comparisons, this is the color magnitude relations from the SDSS by Hogg et al., which seems to show the reasonable sort of red sequence that's comparable. Well, our simulation seems to be more or less comparable with the observed red sequence in SDSS. But there's a striking difference if you go out to very bright galaxies. First thing you notice is that the galaxies are too blue. These galaxies are too blue. The second thing you notice is that some of these galaxies seems to be way too bright. It has an R-band magnitude of about -28. So it goes as far out as that. So there seems to be two problems. These massive galaxies seems to be too blue, and they also seem to be too massive. On the bottom panel, what we do is that what happens if you take these simulation, flag all the particle, stellar particle which formed in the last 5 giga-year. Take those particles out from your analysis. Now what that does is that it takes all of these blue galaxies up in the main red sequence. But you notice that there's still some of these brightest galaxies are still too bright compared to what we see in the observations. What this indicates, I think, is that there are two problems are related, but these are really different problems. I think in order to fix this blueness, the late star formation, you can do just by flagging out the recent star formation, and that would really put all these galaxies into the red sequence, but then you really do not solve this overcooling problem, or the fact that some of the central galaxies or the brightest galaxies are too massive. This kicks in even higher before the 5 giga-year.
So to what radius are you counting mass in these galaxies?
This mainly actually is, for all these galaxies, it's like we measure the truncation radius of the galaxy, but the most of the mass is actually is very concentrated in the inner regions of the halo. So this does not really affect the main results here.
Okay, so the red CICL is not being double counted or something?
No, it's not. It's definitely not double counted in this case.
The red sequence increases net by construction. I mean, that's the description in IMF. You calculate colors based on certain models. It's fit real galaxies, right? I mean, that's how it can calibrate. So isn't the fact the red sequence comes out actually by construction? If you've done your calibration correctly, then.
The normalization of red sequence, although there is a metallicity dependence, which also comes into it. Depending on what kind of metallicities that these simulated galaxies have, would certainly have the effects on normalization.
Is
that
strong?
That could be an effect. How strongly it depends. Yeah, I mean, it certainly does affect the normalization. Sure, by something like one magnitude in the G minus R color. Well, 0.1 magnitude, 0.1 magnitude in G minus R color. So another thing we can look at is what's the baryon budgets in clusters. The plot here I'm showing you here is that the baryon fraction in the simulations with no cooling and the simulation with cooling. What this plot shows is that the baryon fraction in cluster is very, and it's normalized with respect to the baryon fraction of the simulation, of the universal baryon fraction in the simulation box. So what this shows is that the baryon fraction enclosed within, say, R500, which is half the Vera radius, is more or less universal to at the level of about 5% in a massive system. However, there's interesting slight deviations. In the simulation with the baryon, with no cooling, the baryon fraction is slightly underestimated. It's only the effect of about 5%. We believe that this is the effect due to the fact that the gas is collisional. So it's much harder to fall than the dark matter, which is a collisionless particle. It seems to give rise to the lower gas fractions. But when you actually include the effects of cooling, it seems that the sign goes opposite way by about the 5%. But the main conclusion seems here is that the galaxy cluster is more or less the closed system within R500, but it's not perfect. Okay, this kind of 5% deviations could potentially have important effect when you're doing the baryon counting and doing the precision measurements of cosmological parameters. This kind of effect could potentially play a role. But then I think the cluster is more or less the closed system. What I show here is the gas fraction in the simulation with cooling and star formation. What this shows is that the gas fraction in these simulations are something of order the 60%. So the remaining here, the offset here, are all in the form of stars. That's of order about 40%. Now this number certainly seems to be a little too high compared to the stellar fractions in real clusters, which if you integrate the luminosity function and use mass to light to convert the amount of stars in clusters, it would only probably amount to about 15%. So that was the sort of source of this discrepancy. It was termed as the sort of overcooling problem, where in many of the simulations that you find that the stellar fraction seems to be way too high. Now the so this also means, I guess, is that these simulations predicts that the gas fraction has to be quite a bit low, and in such a way that the baryon fraction is always very close to universal. Now we also did another test where we actually artificially shut off the cooling and star formation after a redshift of 2. Now this does not change the baryon fraction significantly, but then it changes the relative fraction of stars to gas in sufficiently significant way. So if you try to invoke the physical processes to reduce the stellar fraction in clusters, well, that would change, has a significant effect on gas fraction and vice versa. Yes.
Does this plot look the same at all redshifts that you?
That we have looked at it as a slight evolution as a function of redshift, but it's very minor. It's like a plus minus of about 0.1 or so out to about redshift of 1.
Yeah, so the offsets from the baryon fraction between
this is also pretty simple. It's very constant with the redshift. This is very constant with redshift. So what we can do is that there's a good observations so what we do is we take the Chandra observations of the very relaxed cluster, so that you can, you know, in which you can measure the gas mass and total mass very accurately. So these are and see what the gas fraction is and how it compares with the simulations. And so that's the exercise we did. We're taking the sample of 13 relaxed clusters with the deep Chandra observations of the nearby clusters, and so what this allows you to do, this is one of the cluster that's in this sample, the measurement shows you that the temperature profile is measured all the way out to about the R500, and here is the total mass measurements and gas mass measurements, which can be done reliably out to by R500. The gas density profile actually can be reached all the way out, but then since the temperature measurements are good, something about around half the virial radius, this is where we actually want to make a measurement and do the comparison.
If you look at the gas, you split up further into, let's say, coal gas and hot gas. So, I mean, what fraction of the gas is hot gas? What is still coal gas you can force out?
The cold gas is actually very low. In our simulation, the cold gas is something like 10% of the actual stellar mass. It quickly turns into stars. So in our system, cold gas is always like a very minor component, of over a few percent actually.
What's this C on the end of your
critical?
Oh, so this is this is critical, the 500 critical. So it's over densities measured with respect to critical density of the universe at any given redshift. So here's a comparison. This is the same plot, the fraction of gas fraction enclosed within R500. Here are the data points. The data seems to show that the gas fraction is indeed low, and it's in very good agreement with the simulation results. You can do this at the different radii, say R2500 with respect to critical density of the universe, which is about half of the R500. The gas fraction is even lower. Stellar fraction is higher in the inner region, and the data seems to agree very well with this trend. You can also do the similar exercise in the radial shell between R2500 and R500. The stellar fraction is very small in the outer region of the clusters, but then the data seems to agree very well in the system as well. So these comparisons seem to show that the hot gas components are reproduced reasonably well in these simulations. But there seems to be that we cannot seem to account for the stellar fraction seems to be missing. If you just add the stellar fraction, the stars that's bound to the galaxies, which will only give you about 10-15% effect, it will not bring this. It will not. The baryon fraction in such system would not reach the universal baryon fractions.
Would this problem for Big Bang and Lucent. I mean, then your omega baryon over omega matter is completely revolving as matter. I mean, so far people assume that the X-ray the gas is most the baryons, and then it all works out with.
But there's additional constraints on the omega baryon from also from the CMB from this from anisotropy as well, and that seems to also put significant constraints. So I think the cosmological parameter, which we believe, I think seems to have a very tight constraints. So it's either that we are actually missing the stellar components. We don't seem to be able to account for all the stars that's in simulation that's not being seen, or that maybe that the baryon fraction for some reason does not reach universal. Although this is very hard. What I'm arguing is that this is very also difficult to realize because the cluster seems to be a cooled system. No matter what you do to it, even if you have a significant cooling or not, that this number, baryon fraction, seems to stay more or less universal. Now there was an interesting talk by Denis Zaritsky during the conference has a measurement of the diffuse stellar light, which seems to account. So if you take this Vicuña et al. Data points and then account for this measurements of the diffuse stellar light, which seems to give an additional boost to bring it closer to the universal baryon fraction. So that may be there may be a stellar component that's in diffuse form that hasn't quite yet been accounted for, and I think that was sort of talked about it during the conference.
So is the claim then that the ICL has a total stellar mass exceeding that of the mass matter of the galaxies?
If it really fills in, then it has to be. It has to be that way, and it seems that. So I think the Dennis's talk seems to show that it really brings very close, although about 10% offset. It's slightly underestimated by 10%. It really closes the significant fraction of the gap in between.
I'm not aware of any papers that put the intercluster light at anything greater than 30% of the light in galaxies. Intercluster light. If you're aware of a paper that puts more than 30% of the stellar light outside the galaxy, I'd be most interested in reading that paper.
Yeah, I think that there was. I'm not aware of the paper. I think it's a work in preparation. It was the result that was presented during the conference.
It's extremely diffuse, right? I mean, it's just almost impossible to see, right? If it's even more diffuse than what has already been.
Well, so many people have tried to measure this. We have a number of observers who've done their best to do this, and they're claiming, less than 30%, typically 10%, and I think 30% is the most extreme. If there's an observer who now says that they're seeing more, that's interesting. Let's see the paper.
Sorry. So, I think that's the. I think that the point here is I think that the issue is still open. However, I think that it would be very interesting to actually to see if that result really holds up and.
Well, it'd be really interesting to see the result. Then we can see if it holds up.
That's right.
It's hard to reconcile, I guess, with observations of cluster supernovae, right? There is a program. Led by Saul Perlmutter, looking to observe supernovae and clusters as unit one. I believe that all the supernovae they've seen are sitting in galaxies and not in the ICL. I mean, so if the supernova ray tracks the stellar mass, I mean, it's hard to imagine how the ICL can have a mass comparable to that bound to the galaxies.
There are now. Of planetary nebulae discovered in coma, intra-cluster planetary nebulae. And again, I think the numbers are not, this is not published either. This is Ortwin Gerhardt and Magda Arnavaldi, who were here earlier in the month. And the numbers are again, the 10% level.
Michael,
it's never fair.
Well,
it's all, everything is always
unfair, is it?
Yes. So, you know, every measurement is always biased. So we can just get that out of the way. And then the question is, what is the bias?
Right. I mean, if there's a significant age difference, right, between the intracluster stars.
I agree that the planetaries have, you know, probably have stronger age effects than other stars.
Yes. So I think the point that I'd like to take away from this comparison in particular, I think, is that the comparison of gas with the simulation results and gas fraction simulation and observation, that seems to agree remarkably well. And I think and we did we worry a little bit about the systematics that goes into these measurements. So one of the things that we did is trying to measure this Chandra measurement. How accurately can you really measure the gas fractions in these systems? So what we did is try to generate, just go through this exercise of generating the Chandra Monk data of the cosmological simulation, reduce it with the same analysis tool, you know, that's used to actually to obtain the data, and because you know the answers in the simulations, that we try to see how accurately we can measure the gas mass, total mass, and therefore the gas fraction in these systems. What we find is that the gas fraction seems to be reproduced very accurately for the relaxed clusters. At least for the relaxed cluster, things are looking more spherical. The gas mass seems to be the biases in the gas fraction seems to be controlled at the level of about 3%, the 3%. The temperatures are accurate to about the 10%, with no significant bias. I think this is the scatter in the temperature measurements are at the level of about 10%. What we, however, find is that the total mass, which assumes that the hydrostatic equilibrium, the balancing of the pressure with the gravitational forces, this seems to cause a bias at the level of about 10% in these measurements. Now, so this is the plot that I show is that here, the solid line here is the true mass profiles for the cluster that are averaged over the sample of a sample of relaxed cluster, so the subsample of the 16 clusters that we simulated, and we measure how much the mass, hydrostatic mass, is biased as a function of radius for these system, for the relaxed system. And what we find is that at the R500, the hydrostatic mass is underestimated by about 10 to 15%. Even in what we think is the relaxed clusters. So that was the image showing earlier, that the what we call relaxed cluster is something like this, and what we call unrelaxed cluster seems to have the central shift as well as the very sharp features and very disturbing morphology. This is what we call unrelaxed cluster. And so we took all the cluster that looks more or less have a spherical, elliptical or spherical symmetry, and doesn't have a very significant disturbing morphology. For those systems, I think even for the what we think the relaxed system seems to underestimate the mass. Now, so we think that this underestimate comes from the fact that some fraction of the pressure support comes from the turbulent motion. So we account for, we measure the pressure that can be provided by the turbulent motion, and we correct for this. And it seems that, so when we do correct for this, the bias seems, goes away. So we believe that there is about, you know, even
how do
in
you do that correction.
Yes.
How do you do it?
So what we do is the gradient of the pressure. Usually, the gradient of the pressure is balanced by the gravitational force. But then what we do is instead of assuming that the pressure that we put in there is a thermal pressure, we also include this additional term that's what we call. The turbulent pressure, which is, you know, 1/3 of the turbulent motion, assuming that it's isotropic, so the velocity dispersion of the gas, okay, squared multiplied by the rho and 1/3, that would provide.
So
that
you compute this from in the simulations by looking at the gas.
That's right.
And you look at the bulk velocities of the gas.
The bulk velocities of the gas and of the gas in simulations on order of about 2 kiloparsec or below. So the resolution is about 2 kiloparsec, and there is the bulk velocities. I mean, the different cell has its own gas velocities, and so we measure the velocity dispersion of the gas in cluster galaxies, and that would give rise to the turbulent, what we call turbulent pressure. So we add that additional term in addition to the thermal pressure, and to take a radial gradient of it, and we try to recompute the hydrostatic mass estimate corrected for what we call turbulence in simulation. So that's the exercise we did here.
For the real data, do they take this into account?
No, the measurement of turbulent motion is very difficult. There are many proposals for example, you can use the Doppler broadening of the iron line. It's been proposed. If you have a very high energy spectral resolution, you can hope to probe that. Unfortunately, the ASTRO-E2 or Suzaku mission, which has a calorimeter that does it, unfortunately did not work out. So that's still up in the air. Additionally, another way you can do this is by looking at the pressure fluctuation. If the gas is really turbulent, it gives rise to the pressure fluctuation. So if you have a high resolution temperature density map, you can construct the pressure map and then look at the pressure fluctuation in those regions. This has been done and for the COMA cluster, which is actually the merging cluster, but it's been done for the COMA clusters, and they have obtained the number of orders, something like 10%. Somewhat comparable with what we are finding, but this is for the relaxed cluster system in simulation.
So this means that even at R500, we are going to screw up our masses by 15%. Is that how I should read this block?
That's correct. So all we can do at this point.
This is relaxed.
Yes.
That's right. Even in the relaxed clusters, we see in our simulation.
So this is the best you can do. How bad does it get?
So this is for the relaxed cluster. For our measurements, for the comparison of gas fraction, it's been done for the relaxed system. So, but it could be. I mean, for we also did it for unrelaxed system in our sample, and it could increase as large as.
Can you decide that something's relaxed?
So that's kind of based on the morphology that we're just following, trying to what the observer would identify.
It's called type 1 and type 2.
yes.
Or is it quantitative?
It so far what we have done is not quantitative. It's just so following
type 1 and type 2.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Good astronomy.
But then there are people who actually can measure the
type 2 and type 1.
Type one, yeah.
Actually, you're about to tell us a number for unrelaxed clusters.
Also, for unrelaxed cluster, it's definitely we found that the effect is larger, and it's of order about the 20%. It can go up to 30%, depending on.
It's type 1A or 1B.
Yeah. depending on the what we call relaxed cluster is in varying degree of dynamical state. So depending on which state, so it has a huge variations from system to system. But then I think the maximum we found is at the level of about 25% is the one of the biggest one, the offset that we found by brute forcefully applying this spherical analysis that the observer would apply to the unrelaxed system.
Well, can you provide for observers some sort of recipe for including turbulent pressure just based on the information they do? Is there like a building block?
There's a subtle point in simulations. One of the things, the technical things that it's important to keep in mind when you interpret the simulation is that the gas dynamics is followed is assumed to be the inviscid flow. In other words, the viscosity of the gas is completely suppressed. We are only viscosity that we ever gets into this calculation is the artificial viscosity just to stabilize the numerics of it. But the physical viscosity is actually ignored in these simulations. What that means is that if you have the actual physical viscosity, which could come about for the for realistic magnetized plasma, the dissipation could happen. I think the gas can dissipate more effectively than what we actually simulate in our simulation. So the way I would take this is that this is sort of the upper limit, at least in our context of this simulation. It would be a more like an upper limit of the effect of turbulent motion, because this dissipation viscosity is basically assumed to be very close to zero in this case, and therefore damping of the turbulence is expected to be be small. So we expect the turbulence to be a little bit more enhanced than perhaps in reality.
So this could all just be an effect. In the simulations, but not in real.
So it does. So that answer, I think, unfortunately, will depend on the details of how viscous the gas is, and so the way I will take this is that this I will take this as upper limit I present this as upper limit on the effect of turbulence in cluster.
With upper limit generator, you can measure mass offsets at the 10% level between X-ray lines and masses. So you can actually do this observation.
For individual cluster by...
Yeah, but on smaller scales, because like R2,500.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Even R500, you have to use weak lensing data and your error bars get too big. So I think I've seen this in some of this 10% offset and in relaxed clusters.
So the X-ray mass is under consistently underestimated by about.
Okay. Yeah.
That's.
So it is measurable.
Okay. So the next thing I will show is the mass temperature relation of these clusters. What we plot here are the black dots are the simulation data. The solids are what we call the type 1, type 2, relaxed clusters. And then the open circles are the what we call unrelaxed cluster. What we find is that this scaling relation here is consistent with the self-similar scaling relations, what we would expect from the Virial theorem. And the relaxed cluster seems to show a very tight relation. But in most of the scatter in this mass temperature relation, it actually comes from this what we call unrelaxed system. These are open circles, seems to provide the much of the scatter in this bulk of the large scatter in this relation. Scatter in this MT relation in simulations is at 20%, including all these data points. And so at given temperature, the mass estimate is good to about 20% for individual clusters. So that's what this indicating.
And the factor you collected for the turbulent motion.
No, actually, what I'm plotting here for simulation is the true mass that's measured in simulation plotted against what we call X-ray spectral temperature, which you would obtain from the Mach-Chandra analysis by fitting spectral spectrum of the photons that's coming from these clusters.
Process is measured from.
But yes, and we compare this with the data, and data does assume that mass is obtained by hydrostatic equilibrium. So that's what we put here. So these masses are not measured in the same way. We're just plotting the true mass in simulation, comparing it to the observed hydrostatic mass, and so slope seems to agree really well, but there seems to be an offset at the level of about 10% in the normalization. So these are for the relaxed clusters. Put this into to the perspective. These are the previous comparisons of this kind, a mass temperature relation. These are the previous generation of simulation that did not include the cooling and star formation, which seems to show the slightly higher normalization. And what happened here is that the when you include cooling, the temperature of the cluster of given mass goes up. So what happens in this case is cooling is very strong in the inner region. It removes the pressure in the inner region. It causes the inflow of the gas from outside. Now, gas in the outside usually has the higher entropy level. It has a higher adiabat. You bring all the high entropy gas inner region, compress it to the same pressure. The temperature is increased. So that's the effect that's documented well by the Greg Bryant and the Mark Voigt's paper. So this is not the new effect that I'm discussing, but that effect seems to cause the increase of the temperature by about like 10%. Okay, so that's the changes from this simulation with and without cooling. Now there's also a changes in the data. These are the previous best fit to the data prior to the Chandra observations. And so the changes here is actually based due to the accurate measurements of the outer density profile, which Chandra data seems to see the steepening of the gas density profile in the outer region, especially beyond R2500 and out to about R500. So if you probe those regions with really deep observations, what you get is the steeper slope, which goes into the hydrostatic calculation, which increases. It has increased the mass. So that changes are, I think, mainly due to the accurate measurements of the density slope, gas density slope, in the outer regions of clusters. Okay, so the scatter, I think, is still too large for any given temperature. You can predict the masses of any given cluster. Say, for example, the relaxed cluster, it's very difficult to accurately determine, based on these kind of relations, predict what that mass of the cluster is. So what we did,
Can you tell a graduate student how to tell the difference between a relaxed cluster and an unrelaxed cluster? Is that something that's easy enough for a graduate student to do, or does it require the master to do it?
Undergrads can do it.
Uh-huh.
You compare a Chandra image with an optical image, and does the peak of the X-ray emission differ from the optical, the center of the ECG? And to first order, that tells you whether something is going on in the cluster.
But there are a number of ways, I guess, you can do this, right? I mean, that's called, I guess, the use of the centroid shift, how the center shift.
Peak.
Right.
Central
rotation. Right, but then that's not the. I guess what's difficult is that it's different people use different technique to classify the relaxed and unrelaxed cluster, which that's what makes it slightly difficult and non sort of quantitative about this procedure. I guess I see a number of procedures in the literature that's this.
Type 1.9.
So, but there's also this thing called power ratio, which measures the in various ways. People have devised various ways of quantifying the effect, but I don't think there is a universal way in which that everyone uses to classify the relaxed and unrelaxed clusters. I think in this case.
But since those relations seem to hold fairly well, independent of whether the cluster is relaxed or unrelaxed, it doesn't really matter, right?
It depends if you think they hold well. Based on X-ray only data.
So, yeah. So the next thing I think I'd like to discuss is that also for the cosmological application, I mean, not only that we need to understand the normalization mean of this relation, but the scatter, you know, due to this dynamics which seems to mostly driven by this dynamics of the X-ray cluster, which gives rise to somewhat substantial scatter, like of order 20% in this relation. I think the goal is to really, for cosmological constraints, it's important that you understand the nature of the scatter as well. It's been pointed out a number of times that, you know, that if there's any deviations from the assumed scatter or shape of the scatter, it could result in significant biases or weakening of the constraints of the cosmological parameters. So one of the interest is to, so one of the way is to really fully understand what the scatter of these different systems would be. Or alternative way to do this is, I guess, to look for a different observable plotted as a function of mass that would show considerably smaller scatter. That's what we did in our recent paper, where we look for the observable that gives rise to the small scatter. This is and this x-axis is what we call the X-ray pressure, which we compute based by multiplying the gas mass and the temperature, spectral temperature of the cluster, which is obtained by excluding the central core, and multiply those two. Now, what this quantity gives you is the integrated X-ray pressure, or you can think of this as the thermal energy content of the that's included in the cluster potential. Now, if we plot, so these two are the quantities that we think we can actually measure directly, and also very accurately from the Chandra measurements. And so multiplying those two and plotting as a function of mass, this is the relations we get. What I'm plotting here is basically all clusters labeled by relaxed and unrelaxed based on the morphological classification. And we also plot the results for outputs for redshift of 0 and redshift of 0.6 clusters. So we're looking at the different redshift. So this is the mean relation. The scatter here shows plus or minus 8% scatter. So what we find is that almost all clusters fall within this 8% scatter. Now, so I think
X's are no longer independent, right?
X's.
Like, mass and mole density in some shape or form.
That's right. That's correct. So these are these are the two measurements which is multiplied together. It's not independent in the sense that it's
what is gas mass and what is dark mass.
Well, yeah, I mean there's a good relation between them, right? So
that's right. So if you look at
M500C, is that M500C determined by counting dark matter particles?
No, M500C is accounted by looking at the hydrostatic mass profile.
Okay, from, so it's a hydrostatically
yes, hydrostatically measured mass profile.
So you can also look, since you have a simulated cluster, at what the actual mass is.
That's right.
And you could plot that against your Y parameter.
Well, that's not what it is.
Well,
so that's.
I thought I just asked that. The question is the Y axis dark matter particles counted, or is it? Prediction for dark matter particles.
This is a total mass profile that's directly measured within simulation, including dark matter,
by counting
gas,
dark matter particles.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Dark matter.
So it's not the same thing, Leon. Good. You've answered Leon's question. Leon, thanks you.
Thank you. So you're proposing basically, I guess, like you know, to make a fake SZ observation and ask an inference, right?
That's right. So this.
So why not just do SZ?
So that's right. So let me just.
Maybe someday people will figure out how to do SZ.
There are SZ clusters, Paul.
That's right. Well, I'll just. Okay, so I mean, this just to compare. I mean, I just you know just put the same clusters, the relaxed clusters on this line, that just to show that the real cluster do seem to obey the same relations. Here again, the normalization in this case is 10% offset. Here I'm plotting the hydrostatic mass. Here I'm plotting the true mass, and but these are for the relaxed cluster only. But just to get to set the scale.
Observed hydrostatic mass.
This is the hydrostatic mass.
Your axis is then horribly correlated.
Excuse me?
Just like any other X-ray scaling relation. The observed points, as you just said, are hydrostatic mass. Assuming
yes, that's right.
Equilibrium. So, which may well be more true for relaxed clusters, however you define them. But that means that the axes are now, for the observational points, are horribly correlated.
Yes, these the hydrostatic mass and then the R500 that's estimated to give
rise. Temperature versus temperature.
So yeah, and then and I think that this kind of relation which shows the kind of this kind of tight scatter I think is a useful tool for when you do the cross comparisons of the lensing mass with the X-ray mass, it's rather than using the mass temperature relation and so on, I think this would allow you to remove some of the uncertainty due to dynamics in X-ray that I think would help enormously in this case.
I'm trying to follow the logic. If there's a 10% offset between your lines here. Can you say that you are detecting turbulent pressure at level 10%?
Yes. So if you believe in the simulation relation, that's given by. So if you base off of this simulation result, then you would be able to infer Perhaps another better way to do it is to.
I have to believe it. You have to tell us whether you believe it.
Yes. Well, I think the better way is to. I mean, we can also do this with the lensing. Lensing mass would provide this independent direct measurement of the mass. So if you could do that, and then I think that would. Provide a better comparison of this relation.
Well, alternatively, you could replace those blue points with the points that you get from analyzing your MOSFET equivalent dimensions in the same way as you analyze the chamber.
Synthetic hydrostatic masses.
Yeah. And then you might hope for the error, but the scalar to get bigger because of some correlation factor, then it's some good thing to shift down because you're not moving the in the same way you don't.
Could also be that your
tensor intensity
or
just
negative. Well, that's always a possibility.
Of course.
So, as you mentioned, I think this is precisely what you directly measure with the Sanyal-Zeldovich effect. So everything I said about the integrated thermal energy integrated X-ray pressure as a functional mass relation seems to hold, and this is just this is the compilation of the SZ effect, and here we're actually showing this Sanyal-Zeldovich effect flux as a function of X-ray gas mass, and just doing it for the two sets of simulation with and without cooling.
You simulate the SZ observations. You have an interferometer. The interferometer has noise.
For the simulations point, I'm not actually doing the mock observation. What I'm just plotting is the integrated SZ flux within
simulated SZ observations.
Right. So this is I have not simulated SZ observations. What I have done so far here is a more crude thing and just simply measuring the integrated compton Y enclosed within the in simulations and plotted as a function of gas mass directly measuring simulation. These are just purely simulation points.
Done the same thing for
not yet. Yes, this is a work in progress. I'm just hoping to do. But then.
What about interferometers?
Right.
Let me know how you like them.
Well,
I'm interested to hear how you like interferometers.
Well, I enjoy it. Actually, I had worked with the interferometer really for parts of the graduate school. You know, it's. And this is just the comparison with the sample of the of 38 cluster obtained by BIMA and overall interferometer varying redshift. So this is the corrected for evolution effect, assuming that there's a self-similar evolution. And only thing I want to point out, I think, is that this effect of cooling seems to have the effect of cooling star formation has an impact. Not on the slope is more or less constant, but then the impact on the normalization of the Sanyal-Zeldovich effects, mostly due to the changes in the gas fractions in the system. And I think the simulation that includes those physics seems to be in better match, but not in the perfect match at this point with the observational data points. So let me just go on and wrap it up. So these are just looking at the scaling relations of the global quantities that's measured in X-ray and Sanyal-Zeldovich effect. And I just want to show you that the results of the simulation seems to be compare very well also with the X-ray measurements of the detailed structures of the gas. Here I'm showing you the simulation of the gas density profiles in simulation with cooling and no cooling. And what this shows is that the removal of gas in the inner region seems to change not only the normalization, it removes the gas and change the normalization, but also change the shape of the gas density profile. We can plot the Chandra profiles for a sample of 13 clusters blue, the red, magenta is in 2 to 10 keV hot clusters, and then the green one is actually for the colder system with temperature less than 2 keV. The black one that was there was actually the simulated cluster with one of the coolest clusters that we simulated, the 1 keV cluster, which seems to show deviations from the mean. So it's showing that the clusters are not self-similar. At least the gas density profile is not self-similar. And the low cluster seems to show that there's more lower fraction of gas in the system. That seems to be also seen in the data, which seems to show the same effect. Here is the entropy profile, our thermodynamic structure of the cluster. The line here shows the this is for the adiabatic simulation. This is including the cooling and star formation averaged over all 16 clusters. And then this one is actually for, again, for the 1 keV cluster, which seems to show that the stronger rises in, of the entropy in the inner regions. However, this cluster seems to become self-similar. In other words, these clusters with different mass system more or less agrees becomes self-similar at about R500, which over here. Can compare the data. Here is the entropy profile of the hot cluster. This is the entropy profile of the low mass cluster, which seems to again shows the in the inner regions the clusters are definitely not self-similar. If it's self-similar, all the cluster with different masses lie on the same line and exhibit the same profiles. Now this does not seem to be the case, and we both in simulations and also in observations. And so let me just conclude by saying that it's been talked a number of times, I guess, in the conference and also in the colloquium, that the baryons seem to have an important effect on the mass distribution, both in terms of mass profile and also the shape of the clusters. But the details lies on exactly magnitude of the effect, and the details lies in depends on the detailed the treatment of the baryonic physics in simulations and how reliable it is. What I focused on this talk was to sort of look at the properties of the baryons in clusters more closely, especially in comparison with the optical observation as well as the X-ray observations. I think that the cooling simulation that includes cooling and star formation seems to reproduce the properties of X-ray emitting the hot cluster gas in the outside, especially in the outside of the outside the cluster core. I think one thing that I like to mention is that the X-ray and potentially the Sanyal-Zeldovich-derived masses based on measuring this integrated pressure in cluster, which can be done also in the X-ray, can be used maybe useful tool for the intercomparison when you compare the masses from the X-ray mass and the lensing mass in a way that's in relatively more insensitive to the dynamics of the X-ray cluster, for example. I think this would be much more useful. This would be a nice way of quantifying or doing the comparisons of the masses. I think it's just actually battery just now. But yeah, I just want to mention there are some challenges in this that the core of the galaxy cluster does not seem to be reproduced very well. Especially we also see that this the properties of the central galaxy, most massive elliptical galaxy, seems to be too blue and too massive. You know, this is telling us that some of the physical processes that I put in, which is in the minimal number of processes, it does not seem to be sufficient in when you actually modeling the properties of those systems. So the additional physics such as the AGN feedback and perhaps the other processes like the thermal conduction or the cosmic ray, other processes that we have not considered in this kind of modeling might be important.
Which of those three do you think is most important?
What I think is in terms of energetics, I think AGN feedback, I think, seems to have, we see the evidence of the jet interaction of the radio bubble with the intercluster medium, and we see this in live. So I think that, and when you do the energetics, it seems that each bubble seems to contain like 10 to the 60 ergs of energy and do this episodically. So I think the energetic-wise, I think that there's enough to actually offset the cooling of that leads to formation of these massive systems. The details of how the conversion of mechanical energy of jets into thermal heating, I think, seems to be this, the remaining issue. I was in a conference on on this cooling flow conference. Now it's, I guess it was mostly about the heating, it was studying the heating by AGN bubbles. So that was...
The typical AGN is only 10% of the age of the universe, right? So you have to define the number by a factor of 10 and then see when it actually works out.
That's right. I think that when you do that calculation, I think it's enough to actually offset the cooling. Whether you can efficiently couple it, I think is the next question. Thermal conduction. It's been shown that it can also heat the gas, but then I think it's if you do the stability analysis, it seems that it's an unstable heating source. It's been documented even since back in the 1970s. So that's probably a less likely heating source if it's unstable to actually continuously heat the ongoing cooling. So I would not think that would be the main primary source. So I So AGN feedback is probably my current best candidates, and that's something that I'm sort of seriously like to study a little bit more. Thank you.
It's also already final discussion, so if there's one very, very urgent question, otherwise, are you around until later?
Yes, I'll be around until.
Okay. What about just plain old resolution? Do you feel that you have enough, or do you feel a desperate need for more?
At this point, depends on how. I mean, for the current resolution is enough to, I think, resolve down to about 1/10 of the L star galaxies. That's how we set out. There's a significant amount of stars that's down to about that scale, including additional and resolving smaller galaxies. Probably does not result in the global changes in gas fractions and so forth. So I think that in terms of resolution, I think we have enough to at least get the bulk properties of at least getting this gas fractions or relative fraction of gas and stars more or less right. But we certainly do not resolve the dwarf galaxy, for example, so we cannot say anything about that at this point, and we need higher resolution in order to address these questions.
Paul? No? Okay, let's speak again.